The Gladioli Are Invisible. It's a memoir by WBGO commentator and Seton Hall professor Mildred Antenor. And Mildred joins us on the WBGO Journal. Great to see you under different circumstances, Mildred.
Nice to see you too, Doug. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Your memoir, I'm going to let you explain to our listeners what the title of your book means to you and should mean to the listeners.
Okay. Well, I chose the title, The Gladioli, because gladiolus flower basically represents several things. It represents perseverance. It represents determination. It represents remembrance. And the people that I write about pretty much have most or all of those characteristics. So I chose that flower to represent them. And at the same time, they were invisible in the community where they lived. And so I thought that was the perfect metaphor for those characters.
This was a labor of love for you. How long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, my goodness. I want to say 8 years. I mean, I stopped counting after seven. So let's just say 8 years. It took about a year to get published. But in terms of writing it, it took about 8 years. And I wrote everywhere. I wrote at home. I wrote at Starbucks. I mean, whenever you go to the coffee shops and you see people commandeering a table for 3 hours, I was one of those people. And I wrote in New Jersey. I wrote in New York, mostly in New York, I would say. And I can honestly say that I know every coffee shop in the East Village because that's where I would go and write. And there's something about the energy of people at a coffee shop that kind of lends to the creative process. There was one particular coffee shop, one of my favorite, called Bourbon Coffee in Union Square.
No longer, right?
No longer. Yeah, they lost their lease, unfortunately, because of, you know, gentrification and because banks taking up the spaces, primarily because the rents are too high, you know. But I would write there, and it was a place where a lot of the students in the surrounding areas from the new school, New York University, would go and get a cup of coffee or study during final exams. And so I felt it was very comforting. It was a cozy feeling. It was one of those, I guess the best way that I can describe it, it reminds me of the coffee shop in the sitcom Friends.
Yeah.
With the cozy, lounge chairs and the delicious coffee and very delicious, desserts. And so I would go there a lot and write. As a matter of fact, the second chapter, the chapter called Fritz, was written at Bourbon Coffee.
We'll talk about Fritz as we move on with this interview. Mildred, you dedicate each chapter to a person who's made a difference in your life, like Fritz. And some stories are inspirational. Others are outright tragedies. Mm. Why did you decide to format the book in this way?
Because I do a lot of self-examination. I do a lot of thinking about where I want to go, especially towards the end of each year. You know, we're at the end of 2019, and now I'm starting to think about, okay, what do I want to do for 2020? You know, I'm very goal-based. And as I was doing this years ago, I realized that I am the sum of everything that I've experienced up until that point. And the sum was actually from the people who were in my lives, whether it was for the positive or for the negative. I took all of it in. And these people were instrumental in the person that I became. And so I decided to organize my thoughts and put it in a book.
This is such an emotional book. We're talking about The Gladioli Are Invisible, a memoir from Mildred Antenor, where you talk about drug abuse, mental illness, alcoholism, domestic violence. How difficult was it for you to go back into your family and your past and write about it in an honest way?
It was very difficult. People say that writing books like this, particularly memoirs, are cathartic. And yeah, this was emotionally cleansing for me. I had to go back into my memory bank to relive a lot of those experiences, to get into the detail of it. And it was very emotional. But interestingly enough, I didn't really put out that much emotion as I was writing it. But the funny thing came, I think, when I actually finished the book, and I remember this like it was yesterday. It was a Sunday evening, and I remember writing the last word, typing the last word, hitting period and hitting enter. And I realized, I'm done. And I sat there in front of my laptop and I just cried. I cried for minutes. I mean, I want to say maybe 20, 30 minutes. And I realized that it was all of that emotion that was stored up that I hadn't actually processed. And so I was able to process it when I finished writing.
It also helps us understand, you can see all of Mildred's commentaries on the WBGO website. Just type in Mildred Antenor in the search and you can see and hear all her commentaries. And we can understand them much more, even more now that we have a chance to really get inside your head. I love how you begin this memoir. You take us into the mind of your grandmother, Mama Lucy, and how she took her little baby, Martha, who was your mom, from an abusive relationship in Haiti through a wooded journey. Could you start the book off for us?
Sure. Mama Lucy tiptoed into her bedroom to find Raymond fully asleep. These beating rituals always tired him out. As quietly as she could, she pulled out the dresser drawer and packed what little she could manage, bras, panties, and a bedsheet that she could use as a blanket. She stuffed them into a burlap shoulder bag. Raymond's wallet was on the bedroom dresser. She picked it up and opened it. Only 20 gourds, she thought to herself. She looked back at her sleeping husband and mumbled, "Cheapskate," under her breath. She swiftly folded the money, put it inside her bra, and tiptoed out of the bedroom. She left Raymond fast asleep, snoring away to his own content and comfort. She picked up Martha from her crib without waking her, and quickly but quietly made a dash for the door. The year was 1923. Mama Lucy walked briskly and decidedly, knowing that she would never return.
There would be no Mildred Antenor, maybe, if that journey wasn't taken, right? You think about that, obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think my grandmother, Mama Lucy, was, she was not formally schooled. I mean, she didn't have all the things that we would think are necessary for success in this day and age. But one thing, well, a few things she did have. She had a raw intelligence, for sure. And she had a determination that I had never seen in anybody else. Actually, I take that back. I've seen it in her, most definitely, and also in my mentor, who became my surrogate father, Fritz, who I write about in the second chapter. You know, with all of the challenges stacked up against her, she made a decision that she was going to survive this. And she went ahead and did it. And it's just remarkable what she did in her life.
You know, as I was reading the book for a second time, I had just seen the movie Harriet. And there are comparisons, right? Comparisons to Mama Lucy.
That's right.
And the woman who would become Harriet Tubman.
Correct. Yeah, a lot of people have said that to me. You know, they said that. I remember one of the producers who actually gave me an endorsement, Steve McCain, he said, "My goodness, this is like Harriet Tubman escaping from slavery." And I thought, you know, you're right. You know, it was slavery when you think about it. You know, she was a married woman, but it was an enslaved type of relationship that she was in. And she made a decision to leave at whatever cost. Yeah.
And with little baby Martha, who would be your mom.
Correct.
It's not like, okay, everything. She got to an angelic couple that took them in and saved them.
Yeah.
It's not happily ever after that for Mildred Antenor's past and her family.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about it so, you know, so wonderfully in the book. Your mom was a complicated woman.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to say about her that now that the book has been published?
She was a complicated woman. She did suffer from mental illness. And the thing about, by the way, the mental illness was never diagnosed while she was living. She was diagnosed post-mortem. My mother's been... I like to say transitioned. She transitioned about 15 years ago. But the thing is, in Haitian culture, because Haiti is, again, as you say, complicated, it's such a complicated country, there are many problems with the government, problems with the economy, problems with the infrastructure, problems with jobs and all the rest of it. There are so many problems that are stacked up against the people. They don't have time to look at mental illness. Mental illness for them is like a luxury. And so mental illness was never talked about in my family. But when I look back, And as I got older and I started seeing things that she was doing, I realized something is wrong. As a matter of fact, I noticed it much early on in my life. But I couldn't articulate it as a little girl. But as I got older, I was very, very certain that something was wrong. Yeah.
The gladioli are invisible. It's really a story of survival of the family, but it's also, it has molded you into the person that you are.
Yes.
You've had difficulties. You've had triumphs. You've had mentors. You've had people who disappointed you. You've had friends who took the wrong path, a different path than you. You know, many people can say, yes, they have. But in this story, it is really what's so great about the ending of this story, which has yet to end, because obviously, Mildred, you're still a young person and still doing great things, is that you help everybody every day. You're a professor at Seton Hall University. Mm-hmm. You also mentor people, and you also have your son. So you're able to take all those experiences and turn them into positives for the people that you've dealt with.
Right, right.
How do you do that?
I guess the best way that I can answer that question is I do it with heart, but I also do it knowing the consequences of what happened to the people that I write about. And so when I teach with that mindset. And I also teach knowing that I could only give this advice or the direction that I'm giving to my students, I could only give it to them, and they have a choice of either taking it or leaving it. You know, I can't force them, you know, but I can certainly suggest. And as I think some of my students will tell you, I strongly suggest. But at the end of the day, their education is really ultimately up to them. I could only come so far, and they have to meet me halfway. But I do the best that I can, you know, with what I know. And also knowing what happened to the people that I write about, you know, the ones who didn't triumph. You know, I teach with that mindset in the back of my mind. It's always going in the back of my head, you know. And so I feel that if I didn't do that, I would be remiss. If I didn't do that, I would not be doing my job.
Let's talk about one of those tragedies. You had a nickname.
Yes.
You were given.
Poupe.
Poupe, and your childhood friend, who you talk about and devote a chapter to him, they eventually made his horrible demise.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about him and what happened. And we don't want to give everything away that's in the book, but he took a path that led him to drugs and other things, and to a point where one day you didn't even recognize him when you saw him.
We were childhood friends. His name was Pouchon. He lived in the same building that I did. I lived on the third floor. He lived on the first floor of 1016 Union Street in Brooklyn. This was way before gentrification, by the way. And we came from the same cloth. I mean, his mother and my mother knew each other in Haiti before they emigrated to the United States. He was born and raised in Brooklyn. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. He was being raised in a single parent household. It was just his mother. His father wasn't around. I was raised in a single parent household the same way. But as we got older, he started to take a different path. He joined a gang. He left school. You know, he stopped going to school. And ultimately, this was during the crack epidemic. This was during the crack epidemic in the urban cities. And crack was infiltrating the Brooklyn neighborhood where we lived. And he succumbed to that. You know, he started using it. He started getting violent at home. His mother put him out. And I didn't see him for years. Until one day, and I'll never forget this, on Valentine's Day, I was going through the Port Authority. I had moved from moved from Brooklyn to New Jersey. And it was the end of the day, and I was about to go home, and I realized I hadn't purchased a gift for my husband. It was Valentine's Day. I can't walk through the door without something. So I decided to go through the Port Authority because they had really nice kiosks where they had the nice, you know, they had a nice collection of things to get. So I thought, I'm sure to get something nice there. And so I went and I got my gifts and I bought my bus ticket to go back to Jersey. And this was in the middle of rush hour, right? And as I was walking towards the bus, I heard someone call out my name, Poupe, Poupe. And I stopped. because I hadn't heard that name in years. I mean, only people who knew me from way back would know that name, because everybody knows me as Mildred, not Pupe, right? And I stopped and I looked around. I didn't see anyone. And so I kept going and I heard it again. Pupe, Pupe. And I stopped and I thought to myself, who is calling me? Whoever's calling me is someone who's known me since I was a little girl. And then in the clearing, I looked ahead and I saw a homeless man walking towards me, speaking Haitian Creole. And I didn't recognize him. And I said, do you know me? He said, Pupe, it's Pouchon. And I was floored. I didn't know what to say. And then I said to him, Pouchon, what happened to you? You know, and he couldn't answer the question. You know, he was ashamed. And he said, well, how are you? I said, I'm fine. You know, I got married. I'm living in New Jersey. And, you know, he seemed disinterested. And he cut me off and he said, Pupe, do you have some spare change? And I said, of course. I went into my bag, my handbag, and I remembered I had wished I had more money on me, but I had spent all my cash on the gifts for my husband. But I had some loose change, and I remember scooping it up out of my bag, and I took all the loose change that I had, and I put it in his open hand. And the last thing I said to him was, now, Pouchon, please don't go spending that money on drugs. And he said an inaudible thank you, and he disappeared into the crowd, and that was the last that I saw of him.
And he wound up dead.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in the book that it's really a day doesn't go by that you don't think about them.
Every time. I mean, I'm in New York all the time. I still have family in Brooklyn. I'm always in Brooklyn, always in New York City. And whenever I pass by the Port Authority, if I'm heading towards the Lincoln Tunnel, Pouchon comes into my head. Always.
Mm. Real tragedy.
Yeah.
On a positive side, Fritz was a father figure for you.
Yeah.
You have a chapter dedicated to him. Not a blood relative, but someone who really shaped your passions.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
How did you meet Fritz? Tell our listeners how you met Fritz and what he meant to you.
Fritz was a family friend. He knew my grandmother, Mama Lucy, and my mother back in Haiti before they all immigrated to the United States. And as most immigrants do, when they emigrate to a new country, they tend to find each other because it serves as a sense of community. And so Fritz found my mother. He found my grandmother. And he was a visitor to our house all the time, you know, and I would always see him. He would always come to the house and tell us what he was doing. And, you know, he would tell us, well, I'm about to go to Tunisia to get my green card, or, you know, I got a job at the Immigration and Naturalization Agency. I mean, all sorts of things. You know, I just finished, I got my bachelor's degree from Pace, and I'm going to start my doctoral studies. You know, he would always come to the house to tell us what was going on with him. I guess right after my divorce, I transitioned from journalism, from a full-time reporter to teaching. And I got the job at Seton Hall University, and I called Fritz up and I said, Fritz, I was just hired at Seton Hall. I need you to tell me everything that you know about teaching, because he had taught in Haiti, and he also taught in the United States, and he had like 25, 30 years of teaching under his belt. And he said, oh, that's not a problem, Mildred, but, you know, that's going to be a long conversation. We're going to have to meet each other somewhere, you know, face to face. Where do you want to meet? And I said, well, how about the World Trade Center? I mean, you live in Queens. I live in Jersey. You know, all trains go to the World Trade Center. That's a pretty convenient spot. He said, that's perfect. I'll meet you there. We made a date. And, you know, that became our meeting place every other month.
And that year was when you first met was what?
In terms of at World Trade Center, yeah. This was 1999. It was 2000. It was 2000, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was hired at Seton Hall in 2000, yeah. Yeah. So we would go every other month. And I remember we sat at the Borders bookstore on the second floor. And it was always a very simple lunch, always a cup of coffee and a muffin. And I would go prepared with questions, and I would just shoot out a question at him, and he would just go on and on. And, you know, he did most of the talking, you know, and that relationship turned into more of a surrogate father type, because he became, and it's interesting how life works out, he became the father that I needed, that I did not have in my childhood. He became my father in my adulthood. Very interesting. But I would ask him questions about everything, about life, about philosophy, about music, about my hopes, my goals, my fears, my professional life, about teaching, how to make a class interesting. I mean, all sorts of things. And he was always there.
What's so wonderful about that relationship is, you know, he got just as much out of it as you did.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
You can tell.
I like to think that, yeah.
I mean, I wasn't there, but you know, through your words, you can tell.
I like to think that, yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
talk about growing up in Crown Heights, your school experiences in the neighborhood. I can feel the sadness in your words when you describe the gentrification of your childhood neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Talk mm-hmm. to us about that.
Well, I mean, gentrification is a good thing in terms of it cleans up a neighborhood. But what people tend to forget is, what about those other people who have lived there for years? What happens to them? You know, and that really concerns me. As I was writing the book, I decided to do some research on it, and I found out that people who are kicked out or who are forced out of their homes, they either do one of three things. Either they go back to their birth home, you know, their birth country, or they move in with family and friends and they live 10 in a room, or they go to homeless shelters. So it's like society is throwing these people away, you know, because they don't have the financial means to pay for a place to live. You know, it doesn't seem fair.
You talked about when you would write this book in some of the places, and you mentioned, even when you talked about Fritz, you mentioned coffee or dessert. In this book, you mentioned food a lot.
Yeah, I'm a foodie.
Yeah, you mentioned food a lot. And we can taste the food, and we can smell the food. We can also smell the violence. And almost taste the violence in some of these stories that you've told. That's a powerful way to you know, really connect it. I want to tell you that. It comes through. You know, I've known you for a long time now, and I know how proud you are of your Haitian heritage. And so you've talked about your meals nowadays and the things that you like to eat. And so you can see that whole transformation from back from Mama Lucy has really stayed with you, those smells and tastes that you still enjoy today.
I'm a foodie. I love food. I love food that is flavorful. And Haitian food, I have to say, is some of the best in the world. But I just want to clarify. I love food. I mean, I love good food. And I love tasting international cuisine, and I love Indian food, I love Italian food, I love Thai food, I love Chinese food. I mean, I love it all. But Haitian food is right up there in terms of the layers of flavor. You know, we're very big with seasoning and marinating the meats, maybe overnight, so that the seasonings kind of, marinate and stay with the meat and go to the various levels, you know, so that you can have levels of flavor as you put it into your mouth. It's an event.
When you prepare like a major meal mm-hmm. for your son, mm-hmm. maybe in a holiday or what, do you talk about how that all that food originated and it brings back some memories? Do you talk about this?
No, not really. I would talk about how Haitian people are very proud about their food, and they're proud about the preparation, you know, very proud about the preparation. One of the things, for example, when Haitian people, for the most part, buy their meats, their fish or their meats, it's very important to clean it and to wash the fish to scrub the fish with lemon. And then let it marinate with some lemon and some vinegar and layers of flavor, you know, to make sure that it's safe to eat, but also that it's flavorful. So that's really what the conversations mostly were about, I remember, when I would talk to my son about food preparation.
You dedicated the book to Solomon, your son. What has been his reaction to reading it?
He hasn't told me yet. He hasn't
really?
Told me yet. No, he has not. But he would, he knows about me, you know, going to the various coffee shops or, you know, staying up late at night at home, just writing at, you know, at my laptop. And he knows that it's important. He knows that it's important. And he's someone who loves to read as well. But he hasn't said anything about it. So this will be an interesting conversation.
Let's talk about you in this book. I'm going to read what you have to say here. At 10 years old and younger, I was often teased and bullied at school for a number of reasons. One day, it could have been the black patent leather Mary Jane shoes that I had my mother had put on my feet to wear to school when all of the other children were wearing Pro Keds or Converse sneakers. On another day, it could have been because I came to school with a small gold hoop earring or earrings and large ribbons in my hair to cover the fact that my hair was short. Bullied, huh?
Yes, definitely.
And you know, through the years, this has been a major issue in schools.
Mm-hmm.
So being someone who was bullied, how has that impacted you when you hear about some of the students that you've worked with through the years?
Well, you know, in the past 20, 25 years, our society has changed. And we've always had bullies. We've always had victims of bullies. But it's really turned the corner, I would say, in the millennium, where the victims of bullies are taking it to another level. And, you know, there's a rage. There's a huge numbers of suicides with these victims that you did not have back then. And I think, I mean, this is a whole different conversation, but I think it has to do with how we raise our children. I think it has to do with social media. I think it has to do with how we don't have enough confidence in our kids, I think, to allow them to, how do I say this, to feel the pain, you know? And I'm talking about my generation, Generation Xers. You know, we're the ones who begat the millennials, you know, Generation Y and Generation Z. We're the ones who begat them. But we're raising them in such a way that we're coddling them. It's almost as if we're afraid for the soles of their feet to get dirty. God forbid the soles of their feet get dirty. What are we going to do? You know, it's important for children as they get older to experience some difficulty, because it's through the difficulty that you grow a backbone and that you get stronger. And I think it's through the difficulty that you grow the backbone to allow you to deal with adversity in your adulthood. We're not allowing our children to deal with adversity. And that, I think, is going to be a huge problem in our society as we get as we progress.
You did have teachers who you loved,
mm-hmm,
and helped you to this very day. You've had a relationship with some of them. Thank goodness, right? Because if you had a bunch of teachers who didn't care, where would Mildred Antenor be?
Yes, yes. I mean, in the self-examination that I did that led me to write this book, I thought about that. And it's interesting. I had some wonderful, wonderful teachers in my past. And that's why I became a teacher, because I realized how much of an effect they had on my life. And I wanted to do the same for someone else. You know, in the book, I talk about Mrs. Lieberman. I talk about Mr. Bernstein, who I still stay in touch with. Mr. Bernstein still lives in Freehold, New Jersey. Mrs. Lieberman she now lives in Florida. And me and Mrs. Lieberman, we stay in touch. I say we text and talk maybe a couple of times a month or maybe every other month. And I'm just getting over with laryngitis. And we were talking on the phone and I told her, and ever since then, she's been texting me with the remedies. She said, you should get some zinc lozenges. And
still playing?
Yeah, she's still doing that. You know, so it's still there. And Mr. Bernstein, you know, we still stay in touch. We text each other. He just sent me a text about the book. When was it? Just yesterday, as a matter of fact, yesterday morning. Yeah.
There's some other people involved. We're not going to touch upon all. We want you to make sure you read the book. But, you know, suicide is a part of this book, mm-hmm, and a friend that you had and had difficulties at work. But, you know, when I read this, I do see why when I look at Mildred Antenor, I see strength, I see intensity, I see intelligence, and I see power. And those all come out. So if that journey was not taken by Mama Lucy, which included all of those, if you think about it, the strength to do what she did, right? The intelligence to realize there could be something else out there mm-hmm. for me, and I want to find it, right? Mm-hmm. The power just to physically get to where she had to be with a baby in her arms, not having anything to eat, mm-hmm. and be able to do that. And obviously, intensity is a part of almost all the characters that you've come through. Congratulations on The Gladioli Are Invisible.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm hoping that this book will serve as a healing tool for people who read it. I mean, the topics are, you know, some of them are hard to swallow. But I think at the end, it ends on a hopeful note. And so I hope that it's going to be a very a healing tool for people.
How can people find the book?
They can get it on Amazon.com. Just go to Amazon, type The Gladioli, or just type my name and it'll come up. Yeah.
And you also see some terrific reviews. So once again, congratulations. And are there plans for maybe another book?
I think so. Yes, yes. It's going to be another nonfiction book. In terms of what I'm going to write about, I have no idea. I mean, there are so many stories. There are a lot of stories that I did not put in The Gladioli, you know, so there are more to be revealed. Let's just put it that way. But yes, there is another book that I plan on writing.
I wasn't surprised with the power of this book. And once again, we look forward to maybe the next one.
Yes.
And your next commentary on the WBGO Journal.
Definitely. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.